Food writer, award-winning pastry chef, and baker, Justin Burke will be appearing at Saratoga Performing Arts Center to close out this year's Culinary Arts at SPAC series, introducing his first ever cookbook, Potluck Desserts, Joyful Recipes to Share with Pride. During a phone interview, he said this cookbook is really trying to break the mold of what we perceive as what a cookbook should be. We're seeing that more of the newer cookbooks that are coming out, that the storytelling of the food is being included in the cookbook. I had a fantastic conversation with Justin Burke about his cookbook, the importance in its writing, its recipes, and how it almost didn't happen. I'm proud of the story that appeared in the Daily Gazette Life and Arts section prior to his appearance, but there was so much more he offered that I had to ask, and he was kind enough to allow me to share our conversation that went well beyond just the kitchen. Here is Justin Burke. Where is this for you? I think part of these events are, you know, part of it is it does surround you selling a book, your first cookbook, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, first one, yeah.
And then, but there's more to it. So I just wanted to talk to you about, you know, how this came about for you to be on this like type of tour and coming up to Saratoga Springs, and a little bit about the book and rounding out more about you and everything you do around this book.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
So how did the connection come up with SPAC? I mean, obviously you have people.
Pam, like cold call, essentially, like reached out to my publisher and to me and said that she loved my book and wanted to bring me up there. That's how that happened.
All right. It's not a bad flight drive. Bundle up. It's coming. It's coming. The winter is coming.
Yeah, it's coming.
I apologize for that. For you, what's this opportunity like? You're going to sit down with Sarah LaDuc, who I know from WAMC, and I listen to her probably on a daily basis. And we're all friends in media. We really are. We're not that cutthroat by any means. But I know from the last sit down and conversation and in that room, you're almost playing a club scene. You know, in a sense, you're a rock star, but you're playing that club scene. So what are you hoping to get out of the evening?
I mean, with any of these events that are part of the cookbook tour, it's really, I mean, this cookbook is, it's really kind of trying to break the mold of what we perceive as what a cookbook should be. And we're seeing that more with the newer cookbooks that are coming out, that the storytelling of food is being included in cookbooks because, I mean, it's essential to, I mean, we've heard it before, know your food, but that means that goes more than just where your food is coming from, which is important, but it is also, why are we cooking this food? Why, what is the meaning of it? What significant role has it played in your community, in history? Why do we keep going back to it and repeating it? So these opportunities to sit down and, you know, you're only given so many pages of a cookbook. Like, we're not writing novels. So this is an opportunity to go deeper into the stories that are included, bring up some of the information that didn't make it into the book. And also, this book for me, like, I wrote it first and foremost for the queer and trans community and the allied community. To know that a cookbook like this is a possibility, and that you can go and find these resources like a cookbook that speak to you, versus what happens often in the queer community is we're finding resources that aren't made for us, and we're having to do the work to find how it works for us. So there's an opportunity to go deeper into that, directly to the queer and trans community in these events, but also people who are outside of that community, who are just eager to learn and understand more and answer those questions. So I keep it very transparent, honest, like no question is off the table. And that's been through my work, my entire work in my career. So it just is opportunity to talk more about it. For me to introduce them to other cookbook authors that I can point them to that I admire. It's really, to me, an opportunity to talk more about the community, make new introductions, introduce myself, or reintroduce myself if people have been following my career. So it's really, it's just a very relationship building. I'm first and foremost love human connection, and so it's about that.
And I know part of this, you know, it's potluck desserts, but potluck it means something different to you, and you have a different introduction to potluck, because I know part of what I read was, you know, part of this was inspired from your first queer potluck. So what's, you know, potluck, you know, I think we've gotten away from it. And again, COVID probably had a lot to do with that, where we reduced gatherings and things like that. But if we take the term potluck, are we seeing a comeback, or is that a way of forming community? Is that what?
Yes. Yeah, I totally understand your question. So there's two parts to that. There's two parts to this answer. The first is more like, let's look at the global perspective of it. And you're right, because of the pandemic, we were all forced back into our homes. We were siloed. And we got away from gathering. We almost inherited this fear of being among too many people. But what we learned quickly is that by human nature, like, we are not at our healthiest if we're not among our community. So what we're seeing now in cookbooks, and if you look at all the cookbooks that came out in 2025, you know, Dan Pelosi's cookbook, Let's Party, Casey's, What Can I Bring? All of these cookbooks that are coming out are centered around the idea of dinner parties, potlucks, gathering with your community, your friends and family, your chosen family. So, and it's not a surprise, because it takes 2 to 3 years for a book to be published. So all of those cookbooks that we're seeing now were pitched during the pandemic. But we're reintroducing the concept of that and what it looks like now after going through what we did with 2020 and 2021. So I don't think we are getting away from it. I think we're entering a new version of that, which runs parallel with just how we approach the food system and how we, I mean, we're, even our culture of eating out all the time has changed. Like, we are seeing more people cooking at home because they had to, but they are now empowered to cook more home meals and enjoy restaurant dining, but appreciate it more as just a higher appreciation than just like, oh, there's always a restaurant around the corner, I can just go. Like, they're appreciating what those workers, that talent is, versus what it would have been 5 years ago. So that's one part, one answer. When it comes to potluck, when it comes to the queer community, those have been essential to our existence for decades. And what, like, we don't, and I say it in the book directly, like, we don't own potlucks. We didn't invent potlucks. Potlucks are been around forever. They're called different things. But what in the queer and trans community we've done is, when our history has been erased and not well documented, and we've been told that we don't exist, what we've done is gather among our chosen family, and we have safeguarded our history, our oral history, and our legacies through food. Because what you do at potlucks, any potluck, when you love a recipe and it tastes like so good, you immediately say, who made this? Can I get the recipe? And with that comes the story of where it's from. It's like, that's my Aunt Jo's carrot salad, you know? And so you learn about Aunt Jo. And then when you make it, you're adding your story and narrative to it. And that's the significance of queer potlucks is, for me, that is where I learned about Lavender Scare and what I learned about, you know, the brownies being baked by the dozens for AIDS clinics, and, you know, getting a first perspective retelling of being at Stonewall, and you learn so much more. We have kept that safe, and we've been able to pass it on from generation to generation, and also give significant value to the individuals that have contributed so much to our community's success of persisting and thriving, even though it's not documented, it's not in books, it's not celebrated in mainstream media. We have celebrated them while gathering together with food. So that's the significance of queer potlucks. And that's the significance of why that is the foundation and the heart of Potluck Desserts, a cookbook. It ties it all together. It ties the storytelling and the recipes, and it kind of brings it all together in one body of work.
So throughout your career, you've been in the kitchen, and then you've been in publications.
Yes. Yep.
How hard is it? Did you find, you know, did you find the cookbook Potluck Desserts? Did Potluck Desserts find you? How did it come about as your first?
It's a great question. I mean, I think for me, like, what my career has been very interesting, and I always tell people when they ask me, like, what advice can I give them? I'm like, oh, don't follow my path. Because it was just very, I don't want to say chaotic, but it was very haphazard. It was just very haphazard. And sometimes there were moments where I was very confused of what was happening and what I was doing. Because when I started cooking professionally, it happened. I didn't get an opportunity to learn and be behind the scenes and my mistakes to be quiet. I was thrown into the limelight immediately. Like, I did pop-ups and they kind of grew a cult following. Like, I guess you can say it went viral before being viral was a thing. And I was just very green. I mean, I was still working my previous career of peace building. And so it was like a mistake I made was front and center. But what I did was I always remembered to steward relationships. And I'm very fortunate to have had a successful career where I've met amazing editors at food publications. And that is what helped me transition into food writing. And I think with that natural progression, you know, we hear it in publications, like, a chef can be an amazing chef and develop wonderful recipes, but they're a horrible writer, or vice versa. You can be a wonderful food writer, but have horrible recipes. And I was being told that I was pretty good at both, and so I should consider a cookbook. But I was very persistent that I didn't want the cookbook to be another cookbook about pies, or for it to be a pastry book that were these elaborate, unapproachable desserts that I knew no home baker was ever going to make. I wanted to really honor my roots, which is I'm self-taught, and I love nostalgia, American comfort desserts, and I don't see enough of that, or at the time didn't see enough of that in cookbooks. And so I really wanted to speak to beginner, first-time nervous bakers and kind of build their confidence. But I also wanted to speak to my queer and trans community. I wanted to see a cookbook that wasn't campy or play into stereotypes or art caricatures that mainstream media likes to play. So I wanted it to be queer positive and queer centered. And that was the pushback from so many publications, was that they didn't want me to talk about being gay. They didn't want me to talk about having a child, like, and married to a man. Like, they were like, get rid of that and just, like, talk about desserts. But I refused, and I was like, it's not worth, like, me erasing my identity is not worth me just getting a deal. And then I think really trying to define and help as I continue to write about what queer food is, and adding more to that narrative that so many wonderful writers are doing, queer potlucks popped into my mind, and I felt like that was the anchor that could give something that isn't tangible, because queer food is more about the people and the environment. It's not an ingredient or a skill or a technique, but that was a physical thing that I could use as an example to illustrate the significance of it. Desserts, like potluck desserts, I was like, I want to do my first cook to be about desserts, and so I mean, the cookbook has two running stories that both start in the beginning, like the beginning of us being on our own, exploring and understanding ourselves in the community. And then the recipes are those novice homey desserts that we, when we live on our own for the first time, those are the recipes that we go to first to start experimenting baking at home. So it's these two points of beginnings and how we evolve and build confidence and security and pride in both. And it intersects pretty good in a lived-in way.
The one thing I discovered from the first event is, another thing that I liked about the event is, you're not like shipping this in. You're not working in the kitchen and then arriving, and then there's boxes and cases that are fresh and things like that. You're getting help.
Yeah.
From up here. So what's that like to, and I see it as two things. One is share the recipe and the technique, which is what a cookbook does, but then also at the same time to let go.
Yeah.
Cause I mean, 100%. You made it, you know how it tastes to you. And then obviously the whole thing is replication and paying homage to the recipe, and you hope you strike it and things like that. So what's that like? What goes into you talking to Michelle and Sam, you know, heading into the event?
So that's a great question. I call this out in the cookbook. I never want to, as a food writer or recipe developer, to come off as authoritative. There are those who do come off that, like, you have to do it this way, or this is the tool you need to have. I think that does a disservice of building confidence and building the creativity. Like, it's a muscle, and we want to encourage the creativity and the exploration with food when you're cooking and baking. So I call it out in the cookbook, and I say, this is not a roadmap. There are no guardrails. Like, I want you to make these recipes your recipes. Here are some suggestions. Here's the foundation. Take it and run with it. So in an event like this, this is what I want the cookbook to do. I want it to encourage, whether you're a home baker or a professional pastry chef, I want to encourage you to reference and or being inspired, learn a few techniques or tricks, and make it your own. So I'm very excited about this because I get to see the book live and breathe, essentially. I get to see it in practice. And I've seen it along on this book tour because we've held potluck-style events during the book tour where we had guests, attendees, bring something from the cookbook. If they don't have the cookbook yet, they can bring something that they love to bring to a potluck. And so you get to see these amazing, talented home bakers and professionals interpreting the recipes, but also at the same time come with questions. Hey, I did it this way. It didn't work out for me. Here are some of the things that I thought could have gone wrong. Can you help me? And so we workshop it and we do troubleshooting together, and it's like we're in the kitchen together, around the kitchen island, you know, we're baking alongside each other. So that's the nature of the book. And these events, like, it's a living example. So it's really exciting. I have had people, I'm just like, wow, you did that 5 times better than I ever could. Like, you made it look so good. And I also in return learn things too. So it's fun. It's really fun.
Exciting. Challenging, entertaining, because of the premise of potluck, and it is pastry dessert. It's not a bread book. You don't have 250 pages of bread. You don't have, you know, 250 pages of, you know, sauces and mother sauce and things like that. So was it easier knowing your premise of potluck was automatically variation, not only, you know, in our lives, but also in your baking? Was that easier or was that harder? Because, you know, I think bread, you can almost like narrow down to lanes and categories and fill it out. Whereas desserts are our world. So was it easier to come up with the number of recipes, or how hard was it to start cutting these down and going, you know, I could only have so many brownies or blondies and things like that.
Yeah.
And X amount of pies. Was that hard?
Yeah, it was difficult. There were a few things that were new experiences for me. I think one thing that made it difficult was I was just very used to writing one recipe for a publication at a time. And then, I moved on to the next recipe. There was no connection. This was the first time that I saw multiple recipes in one body of work that I was working on and making it make sense. Like the progression. Am I jumping all over the place? Am I repeating myself with techniques? Like should similar desserts be together with a similar technique? And so it really forced me to see the narrative of recipe development when it's not just one. So I had to actually pull in a lot of my menu writing experience when in the restaurants of like, does it flow from start to finish? When it comes down to like picking the recipes, and this is like everyone thinks this, and I thought it too, you would think potluck desserts would be a pretty easy thing to say, like, all right, we need 75 recipes. Here are the 75 recipes. But potluck desserts are so, there's so many different versions of the same thing, just called different things, that at one point I had 150 recipes that I wanted to make. And I was like, this is far too many. And I then had to draw the similarities. I mean, there's the chapter on casserole dish desserts. You know, I call it out. I'm like, the layered pudding desserts can be called a delight, can be called a lush, can be called a yum-yum, can be called lasagna, dessert lasagna. And so we have to scale down. And then also, do I have too many chocolate desserts? Do I have too many fruit-based desserts? Do I not have enough of these? You also learn about your own palate. I have learned I really favor coconut and citrus desserts. So I felt sort of like, oh, got too many of that. Like we need more. And of course, and if you look at regionally in the States, like, do I lean too heavy on Midwestern potluck desserts? Do I not have enough of the Northeast? Do I have anything from the West? I really wanted it to be as cohesive and even to show the representation of what a potluck in the States looks like, and that everyone can feel that they see themselves in it. So it was really, really hard. Really hard. But I think I did a good job of giving a good representation of what potluck style desserts look like.
On I've only got one current event question.
Okay.
On when you look at your website, and it's been a dramatic month, I think, for anybody who has a soul.
Yeah.
When we look at food insecurity, and there's two sites that you post that you link to on your site, Harvest Hope Food Bank and Feeding the Carolinas. How does that strike you as, you know, again, human, and being in the food industry as a career and then as a writer and then being self-aware and aware of the world around you? How important are those two entities, and what are you seeing down there? Because you're in a different region of the United States than we are up here in the Northeast, and we wrote about it, you know, daily.
Yeah.
So what's that mean to you this food insecurity and what we've gone through in the past 3 weeks?
That's a great question. I appreciate it. I will say that it is no surprise to me that I've made a career with food. Prior to becoming a chef, I was on a career path, grad school, master's, working towards a PhD of becoming a peace builder, focusing on land reform and food policy. Like, food has always been a part of my life, and that comes from the fact that where I grew up in California, have you ever seen the movie Aaron Brockovich with Julia Roberts?
Yes.
That's my hometown.
Okay.
My mother was a teenage mother. We lived in food deserts, literally in the middle of the desert, but we were also in food insecurity. Like we only survived because we had access to resources to help us. Yes, we had family members who came alongside us when they could, but the day-to-day, if it wasn't for the free lunches at schools and if it wasn't for SNAP, we would have struggled more than we struggled already. So food insecurity has always been a very, very big thing on my heart and in my mind. When I became a professional cook, pastry chef, there were moments of conflict for me where I was like, it just seems so wasteful. And I really had to understand my role in the food system. And it was also very interesting that we would provide, in the restaurant industry, provide these elaborate meals, but also our own workers are suffering food insecurity because we're not paid livable wages. We can't sustain life, but yet our careers are made to provide sustenance. It's very conflicting. And so that is kind of why I've moved towards advocacy within my own industry of improvements. And with food writing and recipe development, it's very wasteful. I mean, we create recipes and we discard what we've made. I try to be very proactive in donating what I've made for recipe development, or knowing, like giving it to my neighbors or giving it to friends and family, like making sure it doesn't go to waste. Currently with what's been going on within food insecurity, and I wrote about this in my Substack, is just, I don't want to point fingers. I don't want to, demonize peers in my industry. I always want to provide a different point of view and provide resources and tools of what we can do. I think it goes beyond just, you know, handing out gift cards and donating to food banks. That's very critical, but other things we can do just to keep human behavior and emotions at ease is maybe we take a pause on posting food content if we're not contractually obligated to be posting, if we're working for a publication or a brand. You know, when you get a ingredient reimbursement from the publication, donate that $25, $30 to a food bank local to you. So just trying to help think of ways to integrate consistent support for the issue of food insecurity. What's been happening down here where I am, I mean, Harvest Hope is a fantastic organization. They're actually, I think it's next, it's the same week that the event is, like, they have their big day of giving, and it's huge down here. But it's, there's a lot of food insecurity down here, and there are tremendous organizations and tremendous food banks that are doing really good work, but there's also a lot of misinformation, and there's a lot of polarizing opinions. And if you're not within a major city down here and you step outside of those limits, you see more of the harsh reality of what's happening. And so my role is just to speak about it, point people in the right direction, be of any service that I can, donate my time, donate the resources that I have, and never make nothing in my career. I will never do smoke and mirrors. I will always keep it honest and transparent. And I will not do something for the sake of doing it to appease other people. It has to fit right with me. And that's been my motto through my entire career is, if it doesn't sit right with me, then I'm not doing it, regardless of how many dollars you're going to throw at me. But yeah, it's a very important part of my life. And this is a very hard pill to swallow, especially seeing it. I don't know. It's been very, not to get like super, you know, Gen Z, but I'm like, it's triggering sometimes. Like I sometimes forget those memories as a kid. And then I think recently it's just been like, oh wow. I'm like I'm being forced to remember what it's like. And it's not great.
We'll shift here to some what I think is fun because I'm asking the questions.
Okay.
favorite ingredient throughout the recipes and least favorite or most we'll say the most challenging versus least favorite. What's your favorite in the book that, you know, the one ingredient you just like, oh, this is, I just love cooking with this. And then what's the, I love it. I love it. But
yeah, my favorite ingredient in the book that
you wrote the book. You can have two.
I mean, I guess I mean, it makes sense. I have a tattoo of it. I love vanilla bean. But specifically vanilla bean paste. And the reason I love vanilla bean paste is economically, it's the right choice. Like, it's not going to, like, you get more bang for the buck versus buying the vanilla bean pods and, like, using the caviar. But then you're like, what do I do with the shells? Do I make my own extract or infuse stuff? Like, it's expensive and it doesn't yield a long life. Vanilla bean paste is a 1-to-1 ratio to vanilla extract. So if the recipe calls for extract, you can just like a teaspoon of extract, you can use a teaspoon of vanilla bean paste and it gives you a warmer vanilla flavor, but also visually you get those vanilla bean pod like specks. And so it's just really fun to use because it adds a depth of layer to any dessert. If you do a combo of vanilla bean paste and like almond extract, you just get this richer flavor too that some people like they can't put their finger on it, but they're like, why does it taste better? And I'm like, oh, this is why. So that's just fun because it's sometimes a mystery, sometimes not a mystery for folks. The thing that I don't like to cook with, well, I don't really like chocolate.
Is Rick saying?
Wow, is that a sin?
I don't have a sweet tooth. I don't crave desserts. I just like the science and precision of it. I don't ever really crave desserts. Rarely do I do. But yeah, chocolate. Chocolate's really not my thing. And I find it to be sometimes the most dramatic ingredient to work with because you think you're doing it right, and then, oh, it's seized, or something split. Or especially when you move into the different percentages of chocolate, you have to treat each chocolate with a different percentage as a separate ingredient. You can't just categorize it as, like, all dark chocolate, as an example. Like, 60% to 80%, like, there are drastic differences, and you're going to get a different outcome, which, to me, it's just annoying. I get really, it just frustrates me, especially when recipe development and then sometimes forgetting that I used 80% chocolate. And then when you take it to have it go tested at a publication and they used like 40%, because even specify 80%, and they're like, this is horrible. Why? It's not the consistency we wanted. And you're like, and then I go back, I'm like, well, what are you doing wrong? You must not be good at your job. But it was my failure of saying, oh, it has to be 80%. So it's just moody. I just find it to be a very moody ingredient, and I don't like it, but I'll do it.
Regarding desserts, sweet and savory, where do you fall on that?
I was going to lean towards more savory. Like, are you asking me like a sweet dessert or a savory dessert?
Yeah, just where are you... You know,
yeah.
It seems I'll like the new buzzy thing now is sweet and savory is coming up a lot more, I think.
I will always go towards more of a savory dessert. I love desserts with high acidity. I love desserts that introduce herbs. Like, I love an herbaceous dessert. That's kind of what I did in the restaurants. Like, my favorite thing I ever made at the bakery that I owned was a tarragon orange muffin, which so good. But yeah, I lean on the savory side, and I'm known to keeping the sugar level at a minimum. Like, I really do have restraint on the amount of sugar I put in my desserts, because too much can be too much, and it's not enjoyable anymore.
We're going to get you out on this one. This is my traditional last question.
Okay.
a little bit of thinking, but it's okay. It's worked well. It's worked well for me.
Okay.
What's next for you?
That's a good question. There is something big happening in 2026.
Okay.
But I can't say it yet.
Okay.
But I can give you, if people have read the cookbook and understand the storytelling of it, it makes sense what the next thing is. We'll just say it's a continuation of storytelling.
Okay.
But it's something I'm very excited about. It's been a lot of work, and I am itching to talk about it because it's, to me, such an exciting thing. So, yeah.
So like the holidays, it's under wraps.
Yeah, it's under wraps.
So, all right. Well, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking the call, and I can't wait.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I'm going to touch base with some of the locals just about what they're looking forward to, and then very much looking forward to seeing you on the 4th at SPAC.
Can't wait. I'll see you there.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Yep. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.